Good evening and welcome to another edition of Men Matter. I'm Dr. Kevin McGuire, and pleased to have our guest with us tonight, Dr. Carol Tavris. Carol, welcome to the show.
Happy to be with you.
And let me start, Carol. I have some information here I'd like to read as an intro and give the audience a sampling of what your career and your writings have been. So if you'll give me a minute, I'd like to read this for the audience. Dr. Tavris earned her PhD in social psychology at the University of Michigan. In her career as a writer, teacher, and lecturer, she has sought to educate the public about the important contributions of psychological science and to explain how pseudoscience can lead us astray at best and at worst cause enormous personal and social harm. Her latest book with Elliot Aronson is Mistakes Were Made, parentheses, but not by me, Why We Justify Foolish Beliefs, Bad Decisions, and Hurtful Acts. This has been translated into 13 languages. Her other best-known books include Anger, The Misunderstood Emotion, and The Mismeasure of Women, Why Women Are Not the Better Sex, the Inferior Sex, or the Opposite Sex. She's also co-authored two textbooks in introductory psychology and has taught intro psych, women in media, and other seminars at UCLA. She's written hundreds of articles, essays, and book reviews on topics in psychological science for a wide array of publications, including the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times Book Review, Scientific American, and the London Times Literary Supplement. Many of these have recently been collected in a reader, Psychobabble and Biobunk, Using Psychological Science to Think Critically About Popular Psychology. She's also been invited to give distinguished lectureships, workshops, and keynote addresses to students, clinicians, psychologists, lawyers, physicians, and general audiences around the world, from New Zealand to Finland. Dr. Tavris is a fellow of three divisions of the American Psychological Association, a charter fellow of the Association for Psychological Science, and she serves on the editorial board of the Psychological Science in Public Interest. I think that's quite a distinguished resume, as brief as it may be, given the length of time you've spent in the field.
Thank you very much.
I want to let the audience know, it's a pleasure to have you on, and our topic has been, or the thrust of the show for a long time has been, the psychological aspects surrounding divorce, separation, effects on children, families, the therapy, and the sort of systematic involvement of the mental health community surrounding issues of divorce with children, families, and many tangents are involved in that. And to a lot of the listeners, myself included, some of the therapeutic therapy, psychotherapy, that seems to wind its way or has wound its way into the mainstream of the family law, social services, family reunification issues surrounding divorce have gone in so many different directions, and there are so many stories about good and bad. They seem almost polarized. And so I wanted to have you on as having had what appears and is certainly documented for your resume, a journey of social psychology that's touched on a lot of these issues and may find, and I think was addressed well in Mistakes Were Made, a common thread that ties some of this together and gives people a perception of how, literally, as the title of the book would say, how mistakes were made and how people follow down a path of good intention and occasionally lead to that place where we all know the road to good intentions lead. So with that introduction, I guess I'd like to start with, You graduated from the University of Michigan. How did you get to where you are now? What was the path that you chose?
Well, it was a curved road. it was a curved road. I loved social psychology. You know, most people don't know what that field is. In L.A., where I live, I often joke people think it means you're a therapist who goes to a lot of parties. But social psychology is a wonderful field, as far as I'm concerned. It's I don't go to that many parties, frankly. It's the field that looks at people in social context, the way other people influence us, the way we influence other people. And you know, we are the field that studies love, war, prejudice, hatred, reconciliation, all the things that happen as soon as another person enters the room, literally or figuratively. So I loved that field when I found myself there at Michigan. But after a couple of years, I wanted a break, and I went to work for a brand new magazine on the beach in Del Mar. It was called Psychology Today. This was a very long time ago. And I went to work there for a year. And while there, I learned from these stunning world-class editors how to write English and how to translate psychological research, good research, into English for general audiences. At the time, the magazine was the Scientific American of Psychology. That was its model. I loved it. I loved it. I loved the developing the ability to take really important concepts from our science and bring them to the public. At that time, and really, to, as you've said so eloquently in your introduction, most people think of psychology as therapy. And their notions of what psychology is have come from the psychotherapy world, originally Freudian and still to a certain extent psychodynamic, from the beliefs and practices of therapists. They have the public eye, they go on the talk shows, they write books about how to raise your children and so forth. And one of the striking things to me was how many of those clinical assumptions were wrong. The first book I wrote on anger examined the clinical notions that anger, you know, fills us up like steam in a teapot and you had better let it out or it's going to give you an ulcer or it's going to, you know, give you headaches and hives and all those terrible things. And if you suppress anger, it's really bad for you.
Right.
Never mind your, you know, your mother told you suppress anger. It's called good manners, you know. If you let anger out, it lands on somebody, and they tend to get angry back at you. That would be the way a social psychologist would want to understand anger. What causes it? What in our perceptions and our beliefs and our expectations make us angry? And then what happens in our world to ourselves and to the other person when we express it or fail to express it? So I became interested very early on in the difference between a lot of the notions that certain schools of psychotherapy were promoting in our culture, which the evidence showed were harmful, wrong, and sometimes quite pernicious and dangerous. Now, that discovery meshed with my realization that when you say to people, hey, I've got this wonderfully interesting new finding that shows that everything you believed about anger is wrong, many people do not say, why, thank you so much for pointing this out to me. I will change my ways immediately. They tell you what you can do with your stupid book, you know?
They in fact, get angry.
Exactly, exactly. So yeah. From that first book I wrote on anger to the latest book with Elliot Aronson on self-justification, which is about why it is so difficult for people to accept information, to change their beliefs, to give up a practice that has shown to be misguided or wrong, even if it was something you did with the best of intentions and the best of knowledge at the time, for an idea or a practice that is better. And so our book examines how it happens to all of us, not just psychotherapists, but to all of us, how we can get on a path where we hold a certain belief, where we hold a certain notion of how something should be done, only we're wrong, and why it is so difficult for us to admit that and change course. So that's what Mistakes Were Made is addresses, as you know, when you invited me to be here. We have a chapter in that book on the what we call the closed loop of clinical practice, how it works for so many therapists who create a self-fulfilling prophecy, a non-self-correcting set of beliefs that govern what they do as therapists that remain impervious to outside information suggesting that they are wrong in what they're doing or in what they're seeing or that there might be a better way. So we have one chapter on psychotherapy, but we have chapters on how this can afflict scientists, families caught up in divorce, families caught up in rifts and feuds, international relations. None of us is immune to the wish to be right and the difficulty to admit we are wrong.
What starts that? That sense of self that we develop as children and young adults? Or is it a combination of that plus, I guess I'm heading for nurture or nature. Is this environmentally mediated as we grow older? Or do we have some failing that says, I'm going to build this insular world and do it my way, no matter what?
Well, both are true. There's an element of what's, for want of a better word, hardwired. Everybody likes that language. But also what is socially and culturally determined, to answer your question. First of all, it's not entirely a failing. What we talk about in the book is the mechanism of cognitive dissonance. This is one of these terms that when people really get how this operates, you see it around you everywhere, you see it in yourself, and you understand better not only how to correct for it in our own lives, but how it operates in other people. It's a very simple mechanism, but it's very powerful. The mind is pretty much designed to protect its beliefs, whether these are religious or political or social beliefs, but also beliefs about ourselves, that we are good, smart, kind, worthy, ethical, decent people. I'm sure you know these wonderful studies showing that most Americans think they're better than average. Okay.
Lake Wobegon.
Sorry?
Lake Wobegon syndrome.
There you go, Lake Wobegon, exactly. And I mean, that's healthy in terms of people's self-esteem, feeling good about themselves and so forth. But what happens then when the belief about ourselves is contradicted by disconfirming evidence, by evidence showing that we have just done something that was foolish, incompetent, harmful, unethical, fattening, and so forth. Now we have a choice. That is what dissonance feels like. Dissonance is the conflict of two beliefs that are mutually inconsistent. I believe I'm competent. I've just done something that was incompetent. I believe I'm kind, but now I've been given evidence that I've just behaved in a very hurtful and harmful way. What people tend to do to resolve that dissonance, they have a choice. They can accept the information, or they can ignore it, forget it, minimize it, and trivialize it to protect their view that they're good, kind, and competent. And in study after study, what we see is when people are given dissonant information, they generally prefer to reject the information rather than change the self-concept. Now, that is fundamentally, that's not exactly a failing. It's adaptive and it's beneficial for us to feel good about ourselves and what we do, to feel that our beliefs are the right beliefs, to feel that as professionals we are behaving in the most competent, up-to-date way. The danger, of course, and by the way, the ability to reduce dissonance is what lets us sleep at night after we've made a decision, after we've done something important for us.
Right.
The dangerous aspect of this is sometimes a few sleepless nights are necessary. Sometimes it is important for us to be able to hear the information that we have behaved badly, that we've hurt someone that we did not intend to hurt, that our, you know, we just cut off the wrong leg in surgery, and rather than deny that, we accept it, we admit it, we acknowledge that we can be good and competent and still be people who make mistakes and do harmful things. So that aspect of dissonance, we will all feel dissonance when our beliefs are contradicted by evidence, but what we do then is entirely learned, it's entirely socially and culturally constructed. We can learn to hear the pang of dissonance, that little feeling of, oh boy, what a jerk I've been, and listen to it and pay attention to it, to understand when we've done something wrong and to make a correction for it. Go ahead.
Oh, just to interject, I'm sorry. Is this where, at least as we mentioned the therapy mode, is this where the oft used clinical experience or clinical expertise seems to bump heads with cognitive dissonance?
It's a belief, the belief that I'm right because of my clinical insight. It's not that it bumps into cognitive dissonance, it protects the person from even feeling cognitive dissonance. Okay. It works like this. We now have decades, hundreds of studies showing that clinical intuition and insight aren't very accurate. If you want to predict how someone is going to behave, you don't want a clinician predicting it. You want to know what that person's behavior was. You want to know objective, empirical information about that person to predict the future. But clinical insight is pretty much the way clinicians, many clinicians, and by no means all, have tended to operate. I'm an artist here. Therapy is an art. It's not a science. And so what I see in my clinical practice, based on my clinical experience, is what's right. Now, what that does, unfortunately, is it can create this closed world. When I was growing up, when I was in college, the dominant psychotherapeutic view was Freudian, and I remember my beloved professor at my college telling me that my desire to go to graduate school clearly meant I was suffering from penis envy, because why else would I want to go into a career that was dominated by men? Okay.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he really did. I mean, I talked that way then. One of my good friends who was a graduate student at Berkeley was told by her psychoanalytic training person that she was clearly a skilled clinician in spite of her unmistakable evidence of her penis envy, which was her dangling earrings. You can't make this up, you know? She was wearing dangling earrings because she envied the one thing in nature that dangles naturally, I suppose, was the reasoning. Okay, that's what we were up against, okay? Now, what did it take? I know, oh my God. What did it take to get these Freudian guys to give up their belief in penis envy? They go into therapy, they see a woman who wants a career, they think that's a crazy thing, and so they decide she's suffering from penis envy. There is no way to disconfirm your belief that my patient is suffering from penis envy. I believe in it, I know it's there, I see it in this person, and so there's no way for the client to say, hey, it's not penis envy. It's income envy. It's something else, okay? So that has always been the danger of the way many clinicians do what they do. If they believe in a particular thing, if they believe in repressed memory of childhood traumas, this appalling, shocking episode of moral panic and hysteria that swept our country in the 1990s, where we believe that a memory can be repressed for 20 or 30 years and then uprooted as if it were a turnip, and we can make these terrible allegations against our, usually the fathers, for the horrible, and so forth. I mean, this was a devastating, devastating hysterical movement that swept the United States, and the assumptions of the therapists could not be disconfirmed. See, when I said before about the need for consonance in the way we think, when we hold a belief, This is a normal bias of the human mind. We look for evidence that confirms what we believe. We think our ex-partner is a horrible, mean, evil person. All we see, all we look for is evidence of that meanness and awfulness. We forget the good things about the person. We don't even look for good things. We don't hear people tell us about good things. This is a natural way the mind works to want to confirm our beliefs, whether it's about other people or about, well, any belief that we hold. This is why science is so important and so difficult for most people, because science requires us to hold our beliefs up to disconfirmation. It requires us to say, is it possible for a person to repress the memory of having been raped by her father every day for 16 years? Is that possible? Is that how the brain works? Is that how memory works? Let's find out. The great problem for so many schools of psychotherapy in our culture is that their practitioners go into a school where they learn usually only one particular kind of therapy. They don't learn about many other kinds of therapies or which therapies are the best and most effective for different emotional disorders. They learn one thing. They become Kleinians or Freudians or whatever the particular view might be. And then that's how they learn to see the behavior of people who come into their practice. Nothing, they have nothing in their professional world to disconfirm the beliefs that they hold when they go into therapy. So this is the reason therapists who are still using the Rorschach inkblot test and other projective tests that are supposed to be able to diagnose the person, these tests have been discredited for more than 50 years. And the fact that any clinicians are still using them is a disgrace to anyone in the psychological science world. Why are they still being used? Because the therapists say, I'm skilled at them. I know how to interpret them. I know how to use them. Well, that's self-justification. That's not the way a scientist would think.
Now, on that note, given a practitioner, while we're on the topic of therapy, given a practitioner, if someone comes to them or is brought to them, would the danger there be that that client may, from the outset, find themselves looking both at the therapist and themselves through the same lens, sort of a co-opting the position of the therapist in wondering or discovering why they were there, or these the sessions may take on a tone of confirmation for the therapist, perhaps leaning in one direction through this mindset that they may have? And would the danger then be that the client might, I don't want to use the word astray, but led to a particular arena of thought that might take them away from the problem they were trying to discover?
Well, of course, you see, when a person goes to a therapist, you're going there precisely to get a point of view, an explanation for your suffering, and to get some intervention that will help you feel better or solve the problem that has brought you there. So, of course, the client is going to be disposed to accept the kind of interpretation or point of view that the therapist has. So if you think that your problem is biomedical and you're suffering from depression because of your neurotransmitters are out of whack, you will be inclined to go to a psychiatrist and get an antidepressant or a medication of some kind. If you think the problem is your mother, you might be inclined to go to a psychodynamic analyst. The analyst you go to will come from a particular point of view, from a particular school. And of course, the therapist and the client together come up with what they think is an explanation of the client's problems and what the best solution might be. One of the reasons that cognitive behavioral therapy is so much more effective than other therapies, and we have many studies to show this, is that the therapist's job is to help the client examine their beliefs, to see how legitimate and reasonable those beliefs are, whether in a way to ask the client to be something of a scientist. You maintain your mother never loved you. Can we think of any examples where, you know, she might have shown some kindness to you and so forth? I'm oversimplifying, of course. But the cognitive behavior therapist wants to understand how you're thinking and ways in which your thinking and your behavior might be self-defeating and making your problems worse. This is very different from what happened in the recovered memory era, say, when a person would go into therapy and the explanation du jour was sexual abuse in childhood. It was assumed to explain everything. And if you couldn't remember having been sexually abused in childhood, that to the therapist was evidence that you'd been sexually abused in childhood, only you repressed it. Right. So there was, under those circumstances, no way to shake the therapist out of her or his belief that that was the origin of your problems. I mean, a friend of mine went to a therapist for a problem she was having. The therapist said, well, you know, you've got symptoms here of being abused. You know, I want you to think about this. And the woman said, I was never abused by my father or my uncles. I had a great relationship with them. Well, the therapist said, I want you to know I'll always see you as a sexual abuse survivor. I mean, now that's a therapist who's got a problem, shall we say. But so your question is exactly right. The whole point of therapy is an alliance. It's an alliance. It's called the therapeutic alliance in this business, to establish a comfortable working relationship where the client feels safe and trusted and can speak his or her mind, and with the therapist, they together try to find an explanation and a good solution. Now, when that works, it can be tremendously helpful and effective. I am in no way criticizing the benefits that therapy can have for many people, and especially people with problems in living, as so many of us eventually have. But, you know, if a person gets into a therapy where they don't agree with what the therapist's point of view is, or they feel the therapist is making things worse, or the therapist is creating an attachment, you know, boy, you really need me now, then it's not often wise to stay.
How does one guard against that? And in that same vein, how does one protect or assure that the process isn't used awry in children?
I'm sorry, did you say with children?
Right. In this, you know, in circumstances where children are brought in, you know, the stress of divorce or of separation, or it seems to be almost a knee-jerk response. Everybody go to therapy. Mm-hmm. You know, that something comes in from social services of the court or something. All right, everyone off to therapy. You know, with regard to children in those circumstances, and maybe it's not something you have wish to comment on, what does that circumstance of identifying what the therapist may or may not be, or the alignment, as you say, with the therapist, how does that, with children, get looked at? Should you be present for all the therapy sessions? Should they be videotaped? Is there a mechanism for review? Or is that just a little too cautionary, perhaps?
Well, you've got a lot of questions in there. You've got children, the sort of the mandated quest thing and so forth. Yeah. You know, in custody issues, I've spoken to many judges and judges' conferences across the country, and when I've talked to them, for example, about the non-scientific basis of so many assessment tests, as I was saying before, like projective tests and so forth, and I say, you know, Solomon had a hell of a time making a decision on custody of that child. but he was fortunate that he didn't have psychiatrists to, to advise him. And judges, so many of them understand that it's an impossible situation very often to determine which parent is the awful word fit, a better fit for custody. Judges hate this. Family courts, it's such a difficult thing because what do you do when both parents are good parents and both parents want the best for their children? So they turn to psychotherapists to try to help them make this decision. And the therapists are often in no better position to do it either. They may, I want to say if it's a court-mandated thing, then you go and that's that, but it's not going to be an ongoing therapy thing. What parents want to be alert for in terms of therapists who are treating their children is how the child responds to the therapist. If the child seems comfortable, happy to be there, or if the child is beginning to show behavioral problems in one way or the other. The danger, I feel, is if the therapist is not representing the child's best interest, but instead takes a position. I mean, this is a very complicated question, Kevin, because there are so many reasons why a child might be seeing a therapist.
I wasn't looking for a cover-all answer. It was more of a generalized, yes, the court aspect is very difficult, and I think that, a lot of listeners and a lot of experience has shown that it's sort of not so much a knee-jerk in a bad manner, but sort of, let's get a few more heads in on this, and maybe I'll have some more info. I'm sure that's how the judges are thinking.
One of the most important things I think parents need to understand, if there's ever a question of the child alleging anything, a young child, a very young child, alleging anything about one parent over another parent, that they know that the child is being interviewed by somebody who is competent the child interviews. Many people in the child protection world are not. They don't know how to conduct these interviews. They don't know how to understand what a child is saying. They don't, from the child's standpoint. And, I'm obviously referring to this era of therapists believing that they know that a child has been molested or believing that one parent is better than another parent. And that's what they see when they interrogate a child. And I say interrogate, I mean interrogate a child until the child produces the answer the therapist is expecting to hear. Now, everybody's much more cautious about this nowadays, fortunately, but there are still, in system-wide across our country, many places, perhaps most places, that still have not learned the latest protocols in how best to interview children in these cases. And so that's something that parents should be concerned about.
There is a National Institutes of Health standards, is there not?
Mm-hmm. There is, yes, indeed. Mm-hmm.
But that's not mandated by state law in many places.
No, it's not. And, this is another example of what I was saying earlier, where once people think they know how to do it, thank you very much for the new protocols, but I'm not interested because the way I'm doing it is the best way. It's unfortunate, but that's how it is. I have a good friend and colleague in Michigan who's been working on this issue for many years. She's a developmental psychologist, and she says it's just change nationwide is very, very slow on this issue of interviewing children.
I think I'm here. Deb?
Yes.
Yes, okay. I didn't feel a need to mention her last name, but at CMU.
Has she been on your show?
No, I was going to give her a call one of these times. I've spoken to a protege of hers down at Colorado University in Colorado Springs.
Very good.
Interesting psychological stuff. The immediacy of a child attaching to an interviewer, having been brought there by a parent, and so that transference of trust. If mom or dad brought me here, this must be an okay person. So I really want to get along with them. And if the interview is done poorly, that's it. It's
Right. See, everybody in the system, everybody in the whole divorce and custody system is really looking to protect their way of seeing things and their way of doing things. Everybody kind of right down the line. And I don't have to tell you that in the bitterness of divorce, it's especially easy for all of us to feel that our perceptions of everything, you know, that this is the right way to be, and that I'm justified in escalating this conflict, I'm justified in retaliating, and, you know, this is how things can really go off the rails.
And it takes quite a toll, too. I know my own and other experience, people quote called in and written in, and people I've met. I recall thinking this in my own mind, perhaps watching too much CSI, perhaps. But I talked with a psychology-type person one time, and in the first 5 minutes, I remember thinking to myself, anything I feel can and will be used against me.
mm-hmm.
You know, sort of, mm-hmm. I'm too happy, I'm not serious. I'm serious. Where's my lightness? I talk too much. I talk too little. It was sort of, I found it very constricting. Not that I was trying to please anybody, but I just thought, there's no right answer. And as a friend of mine once said, there's not much room on a microscope slide to be yourself.
Exactly.
And I think that is part of the difference between going to therapy, which, you know, I've done that myself in way back when things were in the early stages when I was getting divorced. And it was great. It was a listening session, and you could talk and say this and say that. There was no expectation and no repercussion. I guess that's the best way to put it. And it was great. And then it was also limited. Get out of here. You're fine. I don't need to see you next week. Beat it. You know, it, almost a reassuring way of saying, you know, you're fine. Don't come in. We have sick people. Go home. You're not sick. You know, that type thing. But too often I find that people call in and say, my gosh, it's now year five, you know?
Yeah, right.
I mean, even Freud would have to say, wait a minute. Are you both sleeping on different couches and you wake up and forget what you did? I mean, let me digress.
You know, Kevin, though, excuse me, you've just said something really very important, which is, who is the therapist representing when you are seeing a therapist? When you go to a therapist who's your therapist, where the goal of the therapist is to be in your corner to help you with your problem, right? Which is different from a therapist who is assessing you in some way for your fitness, say, as a father.
For your fitness. You know, I was told for the fitness.
Fitness, right? You know, right. Your suitability. You know, so then, because then, as you just were saying, under those circumstances, you feel like you're under the microscope. Everything I say can and will be used against me in a court of law. You know,
exactly.
If I say exactly, so that's a very different nature of what the therapeutic encounter is. And by the way, the third kind of situation in which people find themselves with therapists is a mediation of some kind or a family therapist. Where the goal, where the unit to be treated is the family, which I find, you know, in these kinds of situations, often absolutely useful and essential, because if it can help each partner see the other person's position better. One of the things that often happens in therapy, as you say, that's quite terrific for one person, is you get to come in and talk all about the other. Partner, you know, as much as you want and with all the venom you're feeling and get up and just feel great doing that. But it doesn't tell the therapist what the partner is actually like. It just tells the therapist what your perception of that partner is. And so being in a situation, especially where there are children, where the therapist can attend family is often, I think, very useful.
And I think it is. I know too often, though, in high conflict or in mm-hmm. unilaterally high conflict, it seems more as if, to go back to what you're saying before, in those cases, the mediator tries to take the position of Solomon, but really there is no middle ground. One or the other will say, this is an all or none, and, you know, the
right.
Kind of like the poker folks say, I'm all in with this position. And I think that, that's also difficult to overcome. How do people, we can say all these things, but how do people recognize that they themselves are in a self-delusional or a self-reinforcing position? What mechanisms do they have to encounter? And I'm sure that's graded from, you know, the so terrible tragedy to they stubbed their toe and had a moment of clarity. I don't know. What makes them turn and say, you know, maybe I should reassess? Are there any commonalities to that when people say, I figured it out or I get it?
Kevin, if we had an answer to that question that we could apply on a mass scale, we would have peace in the Middle East by tomorrow afternoon. It's a powerful and very important question. In writing our book, I think that Elliot and I were most impressed by the power of the way cognitive dissonance can blind us to our mistakes and cause us to justify our mistakes rather than correct them by finding the rare and interesting individuals who were able to do just what you say, to look inside and say, let me examine what I'm doing here and change directions if I need to. Writing about those individuals, a district attorney who realized he put an innocent man in prison for 20 years, a woman who realized at 65 that her life, that her relationships had fallen apart, not just because the men were bastards, but because of her own behavior in those relationships. A psychotherapist who woke up and realized that she was the reason for the false memories of abuse that had wrecked her clients' parents' lives. And as they tell their stories, you realize the courage, the guts that it took for them to face themselves and see their part in their own life story. For many of them, this involved sleepless nights and night sweats and embarrassment. See, that's the key. Embarrassment. I'm a good person, but look at this. Look at the harm that I've been creating. You know. Now the good news part of this is that it does happen. That it can happen. That we do have the ability to change our focus and change our direction. One of the most extraordinary experiences for me in writing this book, I don't think I realized going into this that I was going to get the reactions that we've gotten. They have been astonishing, but they come from people often at the end of their rope, very often in a family quarrel or family rift, where they've gotten the lesson of the book, which is all too often we cannot change. We can't get them to say, oh, I'm so sorry, I've done this awful thing to you, and let me make amends. We can't change them, but we can change us. We can change us. We can begin to face our part in whatever the rift might be. Just this week, I've had an exchange with a friend who was enraged at her in-laws and her son-in-law and da-da-da-da-da, and she wanted them to apologize and so forth. And what she's finally realized is that for her own sake, she has to put down the burden of this anger that she's carrying and see and understand what she did to generate their anger and resentment. It's easy to do it once you see that. That's the remarkable thing, to say, have that light bulb go on in your head and say, I've had a part in this too. So what does it take? What does it take? It takes that you get tired of carrying the burden of self-righteousness and the burden of being right and the burden of anger. Those are huge emotional boulders to be carrying around on your neck. And we can be right in the sense that this rift was not caused by us and that we didn't want this and so forth. But being right is not the same as being self-righteous, perhaps. And so when people are ready to set down the boulders, I think they can find ways of that they will find, often to their surprise, are much easier to do than they imagined they would be.
Yeah, and that's true. I've heard a lot of people say that they've gone through experiences like that or had that happen where they've observed it in someone who's been acting in that manner towards them, and all of a sudden the other person has an epiphany. Mm-hmm. It really just drops the weight off of everyone. You can breathe again, and makes it a lot easier, as one guy said, that makes it a lot easier just to walk around.
It absolutely does.
Without having that weight of someone else is saying this about me or this or that unrelentingly, and when the other person says, well, even if it's half-hearted, well, forget it, I'm not going to say that anymore or stick to that, then the, if you will, the target of those feelings says, oh, thank God, I'm off the hook. This is one less burden to have to fight off.
Exactly right. And when you say, boy, I see what I've been doing wrong here. I see how you see this. I see what I've been doing wrong, you know, hounding you and persisting and wanting this and wanting that. I see what I've been doing wrong. I'm so sorry. And without an excuse, without self-justification, I'm sorry, I was wrong to do that. What does that do but invite the other person to say, ah, as you just said, what a relief, but also, now that you've done it, I can do it. I can begin to say what I was doing that was contributing to this. And pretty soon you're talking to the other person. Not pretty soon. I don't want to make this sound like a simple thing. But again, I think the bottom line is we have control over what we do and feel, even when we don't have control over the other person.
And it's
a process. It can take time, for sure.
Yeah, anger takes a lot of energy. It's a really high-maintenance emotion.
Anger?
Anger is a high maintenance emotion, and it really takes effort to maintain it. You have to get up and fuel it.
Yeah, that was one of the things in my book all these many years ago on anger. The common notion was that by expressing anger, you get rid of it. But what I found was, no, when you express anger, you're rehearsing it. You're practicing it. I know everybody going through a divorce knows this experience. Somebody says, how you doing? And you're feeling not so bad, but you start talking. You start telling about the latest installment by this horrible person, and pretty soon you're really in a rage. And that's closer to the experience of anger. It is a fire, and we fuel it by the constant telling and by adding more insults into that big pile of wood that we're burning. And it keeps it going. It keeps it going. It doesn't get rid of it. Where what it takes to get rid of it is to rethink the provocations, to re-see the situation in a way that doesn't make us feel so injured and so betrayed and so let down and so on. We have to fix the mind as much as the energy.
Right, and it's a similar journey to the other side of the coin. Yeah, it is.
It's a journey. It's a journey. Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I was interrupting.
No, I was just going to say that is indeed the process. I had a really interesting response from a guy. I was giving a talk not long ago, and a man in the audience from the community had come to hear me talk about mistakes were made, and he said, let me tell you about this family that we've been having for 6 years. It was one of these things where the siblings were fighting like mad. It was the Middle East that nobody was budging. And he said, somewhere along the line, I gave the mediator your book, and I said, here, give it to them. Give it to them so they can see what they're doing wrong. He said, this had no effect on anybody. He said, but then he said, a few months ago, I reread the book, and I called the mediator, and I said, let me tell you what I've been doing wrong. He said, I suddenly got it. We had just been exchanging accusations with each other, and I finally said, I apologize for these things that I've done. I was wrong. Didn't need to do them. These were my mistakes. I'm sorry for them. I really am sorry for them. And then that opened up for everybody the ability to come to a resolution. And by the time he finished his story, he was weeping, I was weeping, the audience was weeping. It was. But who can say at what point on his journey, on this family rift, did he finally say, enough, basta, it's time for us to put this behind us.
So in that regard, just to go back to when we first started, I think you give a very poignant description of social psychology. When you walk in a room, interactions occur instantaneously, visual, commentary, looks, perceptions, etc. In the same vein we've been discussing, is it then applicable to a social situation that, not to oversimplify, but perhaps think of psychology in a different mode than the couch, so to speak, and think more of, I'm going to do, speak, act, eat, lecture, do whatever, and I'm going to have an impact, and I should think about that. Now, maybe that's automatic for a lot of people, but perhaps brought to the fore a little more, particularly in situations of conflict, it sounds like that might be a better strategy going in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think so. I would love everybody to go take some intro with the social psych courses. I think it's a very crucial corrective to how we see our own behavior. As Americans, we tend to see things from a very individualistic point of view. How I feel is who I am, and I'm here, and these are my feelings, and so forth. And we tend to minimize and overlook the effects of the situations we're in, the effects of other people on us that affect our behavior. We see ourselves as shy or outgoing or whatever characteristics. As permanent characteristics, we don't say, I'm somebody who's shy in this situation, but more outgoing in another situation. So by failing to understand the power that the situation has over us, the power that other people have to make us feel comfortable or nervous or and so forth, an understanding of the way other people influence us and the way that we have an impact on others, I think goes a long way to not only making our lives better, but to helping us fix the situation when we need to rather than the individual. So that's my bias. That's my own bias. But it's
accurate, it's, I think, and certainly healthy.
Thank you. I hope so. Well, we've just had a long hour of conversation here.
We did. We did. And Carol, thank you so much. Let me re-mention your most current tome. Mistakes Were Made, parentheses, but not by me, Carol Tavris and Elliot Aronson. It's on Amazon.com. That's where I got mine. And it was a pleasure. Thank you so much. Very wonderful conversation, and I enjoyed it immensely. Lots of good information, and perhaps in the future, be good to hear from you again.
Well, I thank you very much for taking all this time. This has been a really interesting examination of these very complex issues. So thank you so much, Kevin.
Carol, thank you so much. Dr. Tavris leaving us now, and we'll call it an hour. And I appreciate everyone who listened. And Carol, good evening. And we'll hopefully speak again in the near future.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Good night now. Bye. That concludes another hour of Men Matter. Our guest tonight has been Dr. Carol Tavris. Comments can certainly be addressed to the email at men.matter.show. We welcome your comments and suggestions also for people that might be of interest for future interviews. This is Dr. Kevin McGuire saying good evening and a good weekend.